This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
Welcome to the Between the Covers podcast. I'm Heather Brown. It's time for another reading from The Stone Carvers by Jane Urquhart. Often in stories that move us, the most potent characters are those who are missing. When we met Clara Becker at the beginning of the novel, both of her parents and her much-loved grandfather were dead, and her older brother Tillman had been missing since childhood. Later in the novel, we watched as her parents literally chained Tillman to the family home to keep him from following his passion for the open road. It was young Clara who helped him escape and watched him run away from the family towards freedom. In this episode, we encounter Tillman several years later and many miles away.
When he was more than likely 13 or 14 years old, Tillman lived under a bridge that crossed the Nith River in Waterloo County. It was around this time that he began to train himself as a runner, understanding that this was a skill useful to him in his chosen way of life. He ran around baseball diamonds at the edge of villages on early summer mornings before anyone else was awake, back and forth on Great Lake piers at Owen Sound or Goderich by moonlight. While he was in Waterloo County, he drifted once into the city of Berlin and was seen by a policeman at dawn running down King Street after a good breakfast at the garbage bin behind the Walper Hotel. A few days later, Tillman came upon the bridge. Hot, dirty, and thirsty, having run just that morning past the villages of Bamberg and Wellesley and Nithburg, he had seen the river lying like a bent silver arm in a valley half a mile away, and had taken a narrow road to reach it, descending a hill so steep that he didn't see the bridge until he was halfway down the incline. Made of iron girders and shaped like the back of a large animal whose skeleton was being presented to the boy in profile, every part of the structure delighted Tillman. He ran back and forth over its planked floor, across the shadows of its steel beams several times, though he was breathless and covered with sweat. Then he tore off his tattered clothes, climbed up on one of the iron railings, and jumped into the green-brown water beneath, which he had figured would be deep enough for the plunge. Floating on his back and looking up at the sky, he was able to admire the bridge from below, the way the sunlight shone between the planks, and how the whole framework sat so squarely on its cement abutments. It was then he realized that, with scrub bushes on either side and the incline of the bank, the positioning of the southern abutment created the perfect shelter, the perfect hiding place, and he decided to make it his home. It was a good summer. The view from the bridge was extensive in all directions, hills and fields and orchards being cut into geometric shapes by the angles the steel girders made, and the sound of the water was soothing. Tillman was up before dawn during his first few days at the bridge, skulking around the sheds and the dumps of neighboring farms to get orange crates for furniture and empty cans and bottles for tableware. Once, he took a fishing rod that had been left leaning against a railing of a back porch. He kept it for a week, then, well-fed and filled with guilt, he returned it to the spot, placing two freshly caught trout on the doorstep as a kind of payment. It was then that he first saw the border collie that wagged his tail vaguely as a greeting before ambling casually in the direction of the smell of fish. After that, it didn't take the dog long to find the boy, to scramble down the bank and shimmy into the cave Tillman had made for himself. The dog approached the boy with courteous discretion, his ears down, his tail moving in circles. Tillman named him Buster, changing it only when the dog responded to a faraway human voice calling for Shep. Shep arrived at least once a day, sometimes much more often. Tillman loved the bridge with a child's love, the way a boy will love a treehouse in the yard or a clubhouse in a scrub lot. But he loved it too in a way peculiar to his own nature, because it gave him shelter without closing him in, and always below him there was the river, solemnly moving and changing, going somewhere else. Tillman knew the river was heading west, At the end of August, a week and a half of torrential rain made it hurry in that direction. Then, in the middle of September, a small punt came bobbing swiftly around the bend, a quarter mile upriver, and Tillman and the dog ran down to the bank to meet it. Its appearance seemed like a miracle, for Tillman was aware that soon he would have to follow in the wake of the migrating birds, and now he would have a vehicle for the journey. He floated away in the middle of September, leaving the dog barking wildly on the beloved bridge, and leaving, too, all the various textures of the undulating terrain that had become so familiar to him. He had had, though he did not know it, his first encounter with intimacy, his first experience of knowing something, anything, so well and in such proximity that he would never forget it. He had seen the bridge in every kind of summer light and darkness, knew the sounds it made when it supported wagons or motor cars or the odd bicyclist. Years later, he would be able to close his eyes and see the exact patterns of rust on steel, the distinct black and white markings of a dog's coat, or the way tall grasses bend in a breeze near the margins of a river. And when he recalled these details, he would experience also the ache of loss. His first true home growing smaller and smaller, its bones black against the sun as he sat facing the stern of the boat the river had given him. He shouted goodbye to the bridge and yelled words of praise to Shep, who hurled himself down the bank to follow the punt to the edge of the farm. Tillman knew the dog had been trained not to leave the property, so he was forced to call out one last word of farewell to him before a bend in the river removed them each from the other's sight. He realized that these words of leave-taking were the first sounds he had made in weeks, but his voice was harsh and rusty as a result, and choked as well by tears. Each autumn, Tillman had followed the birds to the flat marshlands of southwestern Ontario. Situated on the northwest shore of Lake Erie, these reed-filled areas swept around the long curve of bays or moved out into the body of the lake, forming their own uncertain peninsulas. Farther east, the land stabilized, and here prosperous farms developed in full view of the water. In his sixth autumn on the road, he had stayed so long in the tomato belt in Essex County that the geese were mostly gone from the shores of Lake Erie, and the lake had become too cold for him to venture into. Banners of shimmering gold leaves were streaming past the brick houses where he begged his meals, and the barns were full to overflowing with a successful harvest. One crisp morning, a farmer asked him to stack the firewood an older tramp was splitting, offering him 25 cents, a meal, and a cot in the barn in return. He showed Tillman a wheelbarrow. "Take all that wood the Italian split and put it in the barn. Mind it's neatly stacked." Tillman looked across the lane to the edge of the pasture, where an olive-skinned man with curly grey hair was working like a tightly wound machine, his axe flashing in the sun, dark stains under his arms, though the day was cool. "He's a queer one," the farmer remarked, "but one hell of a worker." Tillman made two or three trips to the shed before the man chopping wood spoke to him. "I'm not chopping wood," he said. "Don't tell anyone I'm chopping wood." He balanced a large piece of oak on the stump in front of him, lifted the axe high over his head, held the pose for a second or two, and then slammed the axe into the flesh of the wood, splitting it into four equal pieces. "I didn't come down here to find Italians," he said. "I'm not Italian. There are no Italians in Leamington. I haven't been picking tomatoes." "I've seen lots of Italians picking tomatoes," said Tillman, "and lots what own the farms they're grown on." "You must never tell anyone that," said the man, repositioning a log that had fallen from the stump, "and don't tell anyone that I told you not to tell." Tillman had met many hobos on the road who were running from one thing or another, wives, children, the law. "I won't tell nobody nothing," he said. "What's your name?" "Mine's Tillman." "Your name is not Tillman," said the Italian, making instant kindling out of another log. "It's not Tillman, any more than mine is Refuto." Tillman thought about this while he hauled a loaded wheelbarrow to the shed. By the time he returned, the man was sitting on the stump, wiping his face with a dirty cloth and drinking water from a pail. He rinsed his mouth and spat on the ground. Tillman shook his head. I think your name is Rifuto, because mine is surely Tillman.
No, said Rifuto. My name is not Rifuto. Who told you my name was Rifuto?
You did.
I did not.
Well, you told me your name wasn't Rifuto, which made me think more unlikely it was.
Rifuto selected a piece of cedar from the pile. The energy seemed to have leaked out of his argument, but still he looked suspiciously from side to side.
Just don't tell anybody, he said.
Rifuto, are you crazy?
I'm not crazy.
Are you starving? Tillman had seen older hobos hallucinate and start to rave when they had gone without food for a long time, or when they were suddenly without alcohol.
Not starving, said Rifuto.
What's the matter with you, then?
You didn't ask that. Ah, come on, I did so.
Tillman was feeling irritation, a barely remembered sensation, one he had not experienced so far on the road. Almost all the other sentiments and passions had visited him. Fear, affection, happiness, agitation, excitement, very occasionally boredom. But not since his parents had sent him to school had he felt irritation. He pushed the wheelbarrow over to the growing pile of wood.
You sure can split wood, said Tillman. So you don't have anything the matter with your arms.
What arms? Said Rifuto. Who says I got arms?
Tillman sighed and trudged back to the shed with a full load.
I'm not hauling wood to the shed, he called over his shoulder.
Then he laughed and picked up his pace. Behind his back, he could hear Rifuto laughing, too. By evening, they were the best of friends.
The day, much like the days Tillman's grandfather had experienced half a century before, had been one devoted to wood. Hardwood, softwood, cordwood, kindling. At one point, Rifuto called out to Tillman,
"This isn't beautiful basswood some fool has me chopping for his fire."
And the word basswood made something in Tillman's memory twitch and jump. His grandfather's workshop. The distant landscapes he had made on a flat golden-brown plain by cutting into the wood. Pictures of the smallest trees and hills and pastures anyone could imagine. He remembered the pleasure of it. The pleasure and the pride.
"Let me see it," said Tillman.
"Jesus! Look out for the axe."
It was basswood, all right. Tillman recognized it from his childhood.
He recalled that his grandfather could read wood, was able to determine from the grain how a piece might crack or warp as the moisture departed from it, where the flesh of it might glow when it was rounded, glazed and rubbed, and how it would catch the light when coaxed into a particular shape. In the evening, the wind that had all day long thrown the last of the yellow leaves into the lake began to push dark clouds in from the west, and Tillman and Rifuto went early to their bunks in a small barn filled with a racket that rain makes on a tin roof. While Rifuto muttered to himself about all the plans he didn't have for tomorrow, Tillman began to carve, with a broken-handled knife, a faraway forest on a flat piece of basswood he had rescued from the shed.
"You chopped every bit of wood in the place," Tillman ventured. "So there'll be nothing for us to do tomorrow. Looks like we'll be moving on."
Seldom, in fact never did he take to anyone the way he had inexplicably taken to this impossible man.
"No, we won't," said Rifuto. "So where'll we go?"
Tillman continued. "It's getting winter soon. We'll have to go to some town." Rifuto sat silently on the edge of his cot and stared at Tillman while the boy scratched away at the wood and leaned forward to blow the shavings onto the floor. Once, when Tillman looked up, he saw there were tears in the tramp's eyes.
"I don't have a son about your age," Rifuto said. "And this boy," he added, leaving Tillman wondering exactly which boy he was referring to. "Can't he carve?"
Nikki Guadagni, reading Episode 8 of The Stone Carvers by Jane Urquhart. In our next installment, we spend an entire episode with Tillman as he learns more about his new friend Rifuto and shares his own story with someone else for the very first time. The novel is published by Viking Press. You can subscribe to this podcast at cbc.ca/podcasting.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.